I'm Marty Moscow-Wain. Welcome back to Radio Times. It's Philly Beer Week, a celebration of the region's breweries and pubs that's now in its fifth year. It has inspired similar events in cities around the world. Local breweries have been growing in popularity and are expanding their operations. Philadelphia also has a long history of making beer because of the many immigrants from Germany and England that ended up in Philadelphia. So today in Radio Times, we're going to get a short history of Philadelphia's many breweries and an update on the beer scene today. And we have two guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studios. Rich Wagner is a beer historian, a member of the Master Brewers Association of the Americas, and he's the author of a book called Philadelphia Beer, A Heady History of Brewing in the Cradle of Liberty. And Rich Wagner, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Also with us is Don Russell, a return appearance on Radio Times. He's also known as the Philadelphia Daily News' Joe Sixpack. He's a beer reporter and executive director of Philly Beer Week. And Don Russell, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty.
Nice to have you here. And if I could begin with you, Don, is there something, even looking at the history of beer making in Philadelphia, is there something distinctive about beer that has been made in this city?
Well, I think just the mere fact that it's been going on for 300 years or
yes.
whatever is gives this city this whole idea of a long-standing tradition. Beer has been part of Philly culture for such a long time. So I think that, really this town and beers go so well together, and more than any other beverage probably. So I think, the history is a deep part of what's going on, actually even today too.
And how long have you been a beer reporter, which probably is almost as good a beat as a movie reporter?
It's the best beat in the world, believe me. Everybody wants my job. I've been writing about beer pretty much for my entire career, which is over 35 years. But Joe Sixpack has been around for 16 years now, so it's been a pretty good run.
Well, let me turn to you, Rich. You've written a book about the history of breweries in Philadelphia. Would you agree with Don that this history, which goes back several centuries, helps to explain the passion and interest in beer and breweries
today?
Well,
let's just start with two examples. The first porter brewed in America was brewed on Callahill Street between Front and Second by Robert Hare. And a few blocks away in 1840, the first lager beer in America was brewed.
Right.
So here you have two representatives of the main styles of beer, ale and lager, both having their origins in this country right here in Philadelphia.
And is that because we were a port city and certainly the immigrant population as well?
It was important that we were a port city, but it was also because beer was a staple of the diet back then. So you needed beer. That was what you drank with your meals. There were other drinks too, but by the end of the 1600s, we had a half a dozen breweries in the city, all within a block or so of another. And if you've ever stood next to Yard's Brewery when they're brewing and you smell the steam coming out, can you imagine what it would have been like having six breweries all within three blocks or so of each other? We were a brewery town from day one.
Well, there is a brewery town section of Philadelphia, I guess, speaking to some of that history.
And that is when you look at seven square blocks that had a dozen breweries in them, I like to say that was the template for Milwaukee and St. Louis, because we were doing it hundreds of years before beer made the scene there. Or to quote Henry Ortlieb in one of his advertisements in the 1960s, Philadelphia was making quality beer and shipping it around the world when Milwaukee was little more than an Indian reservation.
Go Philadelphia. But we are also talking about German immigrants, I guess British, English immigrants, bringing some of their beer traditions with them.
Well, that was with the introduction of lager beer. That started as an ethnic, a German-American product. And in the time period from 1840 until the Civil War, it was gathering interest, or it was gathering popularity. But by the time the end of the Civil War had occurred, it was on its way to becoming a national beverage.
Right.
So it made the crossover, if you will, beyond just ethnic German population. And this new American lager beer that was lighter, more effervescent, and great served cold really took on for the whole population across the board.
Well, it's interesting to think of this history, and Don, then to take us up to the present day, where we have these, craft breweries, people that are making their own beer in this Philadelphia region.
Yeah, it's almost like it's come around full circle, because at some point in the 80s, Philly was without a single brewery at all. But that was also the very moment when craft brewing started taking off in this country, and we saw the emergence of new breweries. Rich mentioned Yards showing up on the scene, and you know they, along with several others, Dock Street, and there was an original Sam Adams Brew Pub here in town. And those places sort of brought back the idea of locally made artisan beers, as opposed to the big national, widely distributed beers, which is really what has dominated the American scene for since the Prohibition.
So, what do you think inspired these craft breweries?
I think it was brewers that just got tired of drinking the same old beer. I mean, they wanted to taste a real beer. They had heard about them. There's several people probably that were responsible for it and making the seed grow a bit, but. Generally speaking, it was just because people got tired of drinking the same old thing.
That you could drink anywhere across the country.
Right, exactly. I mean, something made in, you know, either by yourself. I mean, a lot of these guys were home brewers making their own beer. I always give credit to Jimmy Carter for signing that bill that legalized home brewing back in 1980. And that sort of took off from there. These home brewers eventually probably listened to too many of their friends telling them how great their beer was, and they ended up opening up their own breweries.
I wonder, too, because Philadelphia has enjoyed a restaurant renaissance. I guess I don't know if it's a renaissance anymore because it looks like it's here to stay. But do you see kind of parallel tracks there?
Absolutely. It's all about flavor, really. I mean, and real honest flavor, real food and real beer go really well hand in hand. But yeah, people are more interested in those kinds of flavors as opposed to the sort of dumbed down mainstream flavor that had typified beer and even restaurants in many cases before the 1980s.
Rich, let me go back to you, and something that you write in your book and just referenced is the fact that the beer was a kind of a drink you could drink breakfast, lunch, and dinner. This would be a couple hundred years ago. I'm sure there's some people that still do it today. But this was what people drank, right?
Yeah. In the home, if you weren't buying beer from the brewery, most housewives, in my estimation, would have like an ongoing crock of stuff fermenting, and we call it beer. But the beer you were serving at the table at breakfast, lunch, and dinner was probably only 1 or 2%. It's kind of sour. It wasn't aged or anything, but it was the ongoing beer. And because water was suspect back in those days, that's one reason beer was a staple. They didn't understand why it didn't make you sick, but they knew you had to boil it. And then not only that, but you leached out nutrients from the grain and from the hops and from the yeast. So it was a wholesome beverage.
Right. And we have a beverage here. Don, right. do you want to describe
absolutely.
What we have?
Proving that it is a breakfast, or at least
brunch
beverage.
Sure, yes, a late breakfast anyway.
This is, we're really happy about this beer. This is called DuPont Special Belge, and it is a Belgian beer that was made to celebrate Philly standing as a Belgian beer city. It was done with collaborating with Philly Beer Week and the Brasserie DuPont in Belgium, where we sent a local brewer, Chris LaPierre from Iron Hill, over to Belgium to brew this beer with DuPont. They packaged it, brought it back here. As you can see on the bottle, it's a tribute to the cities of frotherly love. I love the logo because it's got
a very nice logo.
William Penn and the famous Mannequin Piss from Brussels. And this beer was brought back. We just tapped it on Friday at opening tap, and it's available for sale now around town. And I wasn't sure before, but we just found out that they're going to be distributing this beer nationwide, which is a great way to promote Philly as a beer city.
Now, I'm holding a small little mug of beer here.
It's pretty big, Marty.
the mug is big. The amount of beer is relatively small, which is absolutely fine with me. But are there certain, I mean, I'm a beer drinker, but here we are on the radio. Is there a certain way I should drink this to get the full experience?
Well, everybody has their ways of enjoying beer. You could probably even drink this straight out of the bottle, but you probably really do need to drink this beer out of a clear glass so you can see the pale yellow color of it. Usually when I drink beer, I like to, smell it first to see if I can get some sort of hint of what kind of beer it'll be. And then I just savor it. I think beer is really made for drinking, not necessarily for tasting or judging or whatever. I mean, I do tastings and judging events all the time, but this beer really, it's a low enough alcohol beer that you can enjoy it at pretty much you know, any time during the day. It certainly goes well with food. You got a little bit of hoppiness out of it.
Yeah, and I just took a little sip.
A bit
very
of
rich taste.
Rich, and then it was in the background. You should be able to detect just a little bit of smokiness out of it,
oh,
too.
Oh, interesting. Now, Rich, what do you taste in this particular beer?
Well, it's very well balanced between the malt hops. You have a nice medium body, I guess you'd say. And as Don said, it's nice to be able to see the color. There was one beer writer, Fred Eckert, who had a column that was entitled "Listen to Your Beer."
Oh,
right.
So he analyzed what the sound of the
I'm holding it to the microphone.
What the
here,
sound of the foam as the bubbles popped sounded like as a determination of how well right. the beer was crafted.
Do you buy that or?
It's fun.
It's fun. right. Exactly. How much does water matter? And I'm interested in how beer was made, let's say, several centuries ago and how it's being made today. Are there certain things that just have never changed over the last couple of centuries, Rich?
Well, as beer styles evolved, the ones that were in areas that have had soft water evolved into your lagers, and right. the ones with the hard water evolved into your Bass Ale is on Burton-on-Trent. They even have gypsum salts they call Burtonizing salts that brewers add to the water to make it as similar to the water mm-hmm. in England as possible.
Oh,
so that's basically the water as well as the other ingredients, but that pretty much determined the course of the evolution of the beer styles depending on where they came from in the world.
Well, and Don, I never thought of the kind of hard water, soft water difference. I thought more about the taste of water, but it's interesting to think of beer that way.
It's true. I mean, that's really the more important thing than the taste, because unless you're drinking Coors Light, you really don't want your beer to taste like water, frankly. You want it to taste like there's something else going on there. But Rich is right. The way that the hops or the malts react with the type of water is huge. These days, modern brewers, you know, basically filter or treat their water in some way, often with the minerals that Rich was referring to, and so they can make a beer basically taste the way it's supposed to, no matter what kind of water they're using.
We're almost up on a break here, but are there certain adjectives that the beer testers use? You know how wine testers have an arsenal of adjectives.
I think a lot of what is going on with beer tasting is taken from the wine world. So you'll hear a lot of similar comments to the nose and the finish and so on. I hope that most beer drinkers aren't quite as pretentious as that, so that they're enjoying it just as an overall experience, not, you know, something that is to be drunk with friends at special occasions or, you know, backyard picnics or what have you, rather than just focusing on those really specific adjectives.
Learning the vocabulary and learning how to articulate right. the flavor becomes part of the enjoyment when you are with friends,
right.
because especially if you're going to, well, we have two we want to try here today. You know, we're going to have one with our main course and one with dessert or something. And it's just really fun.
We're going to take that short break, get back to our conversation. We are talking and frankly celebrating beer today on Radio Times. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. If you have a beer story, do give us a call. Our guests are Rich Wagner. He's a beer historian, author of a new book called Philadelphia Beer, and Don Russell, known as Joe Sixpack, executive director of Philly Beer Week. We'll be right back.
The United States Holocaust Memorial Museum supports WHYY and presents Deadly Medicine, Creating the Master Race, now on view at the Free Library of Philadelphia through July 8th. This exhibition focuses on the complicity of physicians and scientists in Nazi racial policies that led to the Holocaust and explores its implications for current-day medical ethics and social responsibility. For more about the exhibition and related resources, ushmm.org/deadlymedicine.
On the next Fresh Air, Neil Young talks about his new Crazy Horse album, Americana, which features folk songs and songs many of us learned as children, like Oh Susanna and Clementine. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
The Heart Institute of Doylestown Hospital supports WHYY. Their cardiac specialists are dedicated to redefining what quality means to heart patients. By combining advanced treatments like cryoablation and minimally invasive valve surgery with responsive nursing care, Doylestown Heart Specialists strive to deliver shorter hospital stays, fewer complications, and the best possible outcomes. Doylestown Hospital, committed to serving heart patients with quality and compassion. Full details at dh.org. That's dh.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're talking about beer and breweries and the history of beer making here in the Philadelphia area. And it is Philly Beer Week, a celebration that's now in its fifth year. And the creator and executive director of Philly Beer Week is with us, Don Russell. Also with us is beer historian Rich Wagner, author of a new book about beer making in Philadelphia. He's a member of the Master Brewers Association of the Americas. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Beer stories, beer questions, do give us a call. And Rich Wagner's book is called Philadelphia Beer. And since we're on the radio, do you want to do a little sound effect for us of this beer bottle being open? Whoop! That's pretty good. That's almost in the champagne category.
Tastes like a lemon soda.
Very good. Very good. Going back to some of this history, and I'm also thinking about, and you write about the influence, and we're doing some short history here, of prohibition on beer making in Philadelphia. But you write that at the end of the 19th century, there were almost, 100 breweries here in the city of Philadelphia. And then I'm curious about, what did prohibition do to beer making?
Well, there was already a trend at work to promote the growth of larger and larger breweries at the expense of the smaller breweries. So from that time period, the peak, when there were 96 or almost 100 breweries in 1885 or so, you started losing the smallest ones. I mean, there were scores of brewery saloons that would be just like brew pubs of today that were making 500 barrels a year, some making 100 barrels a year, some making 1,000. But of all those 96 breweries, there were only about 20 that were making more than 100,000 barrels a year. So that's one of the trends that was already at work. So you had at the time of Prohibition in 1920, let's just for round figures say you had 40 breweries in the city. When beer came back in 1933, only 17 came back.
Oh, wow.
So while there was already a trend towards breweries, small breweries closing, Prohibition had a big effect on that.
You also talk about, I guess, the creation of light beer, needle beer, high-powered beer. Yeah. As we know, with Prohibition came all sorts of speakeasies and illegal drinking.
Well,
in this
that was
country.
The term that they used for real beer was high-powered beer or high-voltage beer. And what needle beer was when they removed the alcohol from beer, the brewer could sell that alcohol as industrial alcohol to people with a license for that. So there's ways around the law. And so you would buy your industrial alcohol or make it, and then you would take the near beer and you'd take a horse syringe and inject alcohol through the bung into the barrel and put the alcohol that the brewer had removed back into the barrel, and then that's why it became known as needle beer.
Wow. And Don, you were talking about Jimmy Carter signing legislation which allowed people to make beer at home. Were you one of those people?
Yes, I did. I actually got homebrewing very early on with what we would refer to as mixed results. and it's one of the reasons why I no longer homebrew, because a lot of work. And today there's so many great brewers out there. Although I will tell you that the homebrewing scene right now in this city and beyond is phenomenal. There's been a few homebrewing events during Beer Week, and I've had some really amazing beers. I had Monday night, I had a chocolate and chipotle beer that in which the rim was dusted with cocoa, and it was just it was a lot of fun. I don't know that you could sit down and drink a lot of it, but it's just fun. It shows you the creativity of the homebrewers that are out there now.
And Triumph just had a homebrew competition, and the winner gets to brew their beer at Triumph, and it'll be served with their regular lineup.
Oh, that's great. Now, after Prohibition, Rich, of course, came Pennsylvania's Liquor Control Board and all the laws that rule liquor in the state of Pennsylvania. What impact on beer drinking and beer making would you say?
Well, this is a part of a larger national trend, but whatever liquor control agencies were formed in whatever state, what they wanted to do was to solve the sins of the past. So the reason Prohibition came to be was because of the saloon. The saloon was associated with prostitution, gambling, drunkenness. It They blamed domestic violence on alcoholism and so forth. So what you tried to do, they had reined in on it. They had this absolute failure called prohibition. So they said, okay, we're going to figure out ways to regulate this so that we don't have the same problems we did 20 years ago.
Yeah, and for beer drinkers in Pennsylvania?
Well, you know, so many of those rules written in 1933 are still on the books. I mean, the whole phrase problem saloon, I think, is still as part of the code. And, you know, we know today that bars have, you know, really in the last 10, 15 years have totally changed. They're much more involved in entertainment. There's family atmosphere there. So there's a big change in a lot of the bars in this city. And that's really what's going on with the craft beer scene. But, you know, I got to tell you, one of the things I hear an awful lot about is how onerous Pennsylvania's rules are. And I'm not a huge fan of the LCB, believe me. But, you know, every state has these same kind of weird rules. And I think that Pennsylvania beer drinkers have done pretty well by the rules that are going, you know, it's out there right now. It's hard to get around them. Sometimes they're confusing. But that said, we got an awful lot of great beer in this city despite those rules.
Yeah. And this is, you know, nothing controversial here, but the idea of responsible drinking, I mean, is a hallmark of certainly what Beer Week is about and what any restaurant or pub should be about as well.
Oh, yeah. And nobody should be drinking and driving, first of all. That's the number one thing. But secondly, you know, the bars generally do a pretty good job of monitoring. I know that all bartenders have to undergo training in this city to make sure that their patrons are not purchasing alcohol while they're drunk. Yeah, there's problems. I think there's always going to be problems abusing alcohol. But craft beer, though, you don't see it as much because a lot of what's going on with craft beer is moderation, drinking it with food. It's not just about getting drunk. It's right. about enjoying the actual liquid.
Go ahead.
And to come back to the repeal time period, when the brewers were interviewed by journalists, well, how much alcohol do you think beer should have? And several that were interviewed said, well, the beer they made during World War I, which was 2.75, was a really good beer, and it was about the same profile, both in alcohol and flavor, as some of the best beer brewed in Germany.
Huh.
And so they said, this idea that this doesn't give me a kick or something is these young people who grew up on bathtub gin and illegal booze during Prohibition.
We just drank too much.
Well, huh? the brewer themselves said, you know, prior to Prohibition, beer wasn't something you drank to get drunk. You drank it with food. You had an afternoon with your family and friends in the beer garden or the picnic and so forth. It wasn't considered an intoxicant.
Yeah, yeah. Some sort of cautionary tales, I think, associated with Prohibition. Don, going back to you and thinking about craft beer, that's C-R-A-F-T, not with a K, but that's still a smaller percent, it's still a pretty small percent of the beer that's being made.
It is. I guess it's sort of equivalent to restaurants where there's a lot more McDonald's out there than there are, you know, fine dining establishments, and there's still the same way with beer where most of the beer is basically mainstream light beer, which I don't really even consider to be real beer anyway. The craft segment is probably in the vicinity of 5 to 6%. Wow. And there's the Brewers Association, which is the representative of that sector, is their aim is to get it up to about 10%, and it's a pretty long haul to get there. So.
Well, excuse me, in preparation for the show, I was thinking about some of the wonderful glasses of beer that I've had. One recently when I was with family and friends in Amsterdam, and we had gone on a bicycle trip and literally were, I think, next to the Amstel River. I guess you can do that, you know, having a wonderful lunch and just a wonderful bottle of beer. And, you know, I can still taste all that good food and good beer.
Olfactory memories are very strong.
They are very, very strong. And we are talking about beer today on Radio Times. It is Philly Beer Week. It's now in its fifth year. It's a celebration of beer and in all its forms here in the Delaware Valley. Don Russell is the executive director of Philly Beer Week. He is also the Philadelphia Daily News's Joe Sixpack, has been reporting on beer for a number of years now. Also with us, beer historian Rich Wagner, author of a new book called Philadelphia Beer, A Heady History of Brewing and the Cradle of Liberty. And he's a member of the Master Brewers Association of the Americas. And we're We're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Beer questions, beer memories, do give us a call. Let me get John from Germantown to join us on Radio Times. And John, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I'm calling because my wife has just discovered beer. She's 38 years old right now, and she just discovered beer. And she's very much into healthy foods. I mean, all organic. And I was calling to find out, are there any quote-unquote organic breweries in Philadelphia or organic beers that you guys recommend?
Don, I'm going to toss that first to you.
Well, there are a number of organic breweries out there around the country, and some actually imported. I don't know of anybody that's really making a locally made organic beer. I know there's a lot of rules about what you can call organic, and I don't know that anybody in the city is making one.
Some of the brew pubs have made them from time to time.
Right. Okay. Mm-hmm. So you'll see them. Yeah. And it's I think it's a pretty cool segment that's out there. I will say one of the things I've discovered with organic beers is that they tend often not to be really hugely flavored, and I'm not sure why that is. I think that they're aiming for a market that they think might not really want a big flavored beer. I think they're wrong. I think that. People like organic food, and I count myself among them,
good
flavored beer no matter what. So
I'd be curious your thoughts about that, Rich, as someone that's looked at the history of beer making, organic breweries times past.
If you go far enough back in time, everything was organic.
Of course, exactly. But,
I think right now most of the hops are coming either from New Zealand. Was it New Zealand where the organic hops are grown?
Exactly.
And I'm not sure where the barley's being grown. So it limits what your raw materials are to some extent, but it's just another niche. That's one of the beauties of this is there's so many directions you can take with what kind of beer you're going to make, and we've just opened the floodgates to that.
Mm. One of the things I noticed looking through your book are just all the beautiful labels. I mean, all the labels that were used over the years for various kinds of beer.
I wrote an article several years ago called Long Lost Lagers of Philadelphia. And just the names, it's like a German 101. and the labels are beautiful, and that touches on one of the main parts of my research is getting to know collectors, having them share their collections with me, allowing me to photograph them. And that's where all these beautiful images came from, in addition to libraries and museums, are from collectors. And you know, before television advertising and radio advertising, they had a lithograph with a calendar on it to hang in the saloon, or they had a beer tray with the, you know, your St. Pauli girls style waitress, or, you know, there's just so much advertising art involved.
And I'm assuming, are there recipes of several hundred years ago that can be recreated today?
Well, everybody wants to know. Yeah, I'm a home brewer, and I want to make a beer like Furman and Schmidt did in Shamokin in 1950.
Exactly.
Well, good luck. You know, that recipe died with the brewer. You know, it's proprietary. I did come across the Brewer's Day Book from the Perot Brewery that was on Vine Street in the early 1800s.
Oh, wow.
And the problem is they don't list things in enough detail. There's all these different varieties of barley. There's different varieties of hops. And so you can get an idea of what they were doing, but it's very, very difficult to actually come up, unless your great-great-grandfather had it scrawled on a piece of paper and it's in with his stuff, that you're going to find a recipe from antiquity.
Anything you want to add to that, Don?
You're starting to see a few of the breweries come back with their old recipes. I know Coors did that with one of their beers, which is actually pretty good. And several other the big breweries that have been around for a long time, every once in a while they'll come back and, well, this is a recreation of the original recipe. So,
let me get, looks like Amy from Bucks County to join our conversation. And Amy, go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you very much for taking my call.
You're very welcome. You're on the air.
I'm calling because my son is in his early 30s, and he's very, very interested in beer and craft brews. He took an extensive course and passed the test to become a judge at beer festivals across the country. When he vacations, he travels to the various craft breweries in the area that he's vacationing in and plans his trip around that. He takes every opportunity to volunteer to work festivals for his friends who own breweries and who are in the business, and he's even organized beer pairing dinners, like food and beer together.
Wow.
And what he'd really like to do is find a job in the craft brewery industry, not necessarily as a brewer, but more in the sales and marketing side.
Right.
And I'm wondering if you have any tips for him.
Well, that's interesting, Amy, because it sounds like he's really immersed himself in the world of beer. But I'll toss that first to Don Russell.
I get that question a lot. A lot of my readers contact me, and I often share their information with the brewers and businesses out there. It depends on where you're looking to get in on the business. The jobs everywhere are tight, I guess, and it is hard to break in. I tell people that the volunteering idea is a great way to get to meet people. That's the number way to get a job anyway. There are sales jobs that open up a lot of times. I will tell you that in my experience, when wholesalers start hiring people to sell their beer, they're usually, you got to start by repping, you know, the mainstream beers. They won't put you on that high-end account at the very beginning. So you need to have a little bit of experience before you can go that route.
Any thoughts, Rich?
Well, just reiterating what you said, doing all the stuff that he's done, is he's positioned himself well. And with a little networking, he'll probably find something.
Well, Amy, good luck, and thanks for calling into Radio Times. You can call as well, 1-888-477-9499. I keep going back to these, hosting contests, but I am interested in the kind of skills, even Amy's call reminded me of that, the kind of skills that you need to have to be able to judge a beer. I mean, what is, the best beer? What is the second best beer? And how subjective that can be done.
I think it is very subjective, but I don't do it myself because I've met people with amazing palates who can really detect flavors that I just don't get sometimes. I am much more, visceral, I guess. I enjoy the experience. But that said, there is a really whole huge sector out there of this thing. There's a program called the Cicerone Project, program out there, which people are actually getting basically beer drinking or beer judging degrees on. And it's a really intense thing that a lot of these, the previous caller might want to look into that too, because it's a pretty rigorous training. It's a good fun part of the whole beer drinking experience, though.
Is this something new?
Well, it's one of the things that really got me more interested in this whole thing. I went to a couple of these conventions, and I heard presentations on something called the flavor wheel. And this is how you quantify and objectify this whole process that how do you tell which is the best, or how much of this, how much bitterness is in this, or how much of this other quality. And when I saw how everything was so scientific and serious and technological, to hear people, this is beer we're talking about,
right?
And yet these are the professionals, and they are taking it so seriously. I was so impressed that that's one thing that kept me going and got me started home brewing and eventually ended up working in a brewery.
I agree. That first time I ever ran into a person that was basically a beer judge or a critic, it was astounding to see that. Beer. It's beer.
And it is beer. Our conversation today on Radio Times, talking with beer historian Rich Wagner and Don Russell, executive director of Philly Beer Week, which is underway here in the Philadelphia area. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Richard Stockton College of New Jersey supports WHYY and offers graduate degree programs designed to prepare graduates for professional careers in business, education, and the sciences, with convenient course schedules to help students grow academically and advance their careers. For more information, stockton.edu/grad school. That's stockton.edu/grad school. Stockton College, New Jersey's distinctive public college.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Rival militias in Libya were united in their effort to take down Muammar Gaddafi. That was then. This week, a militia seized Tripoli's airport. Also, basketball fever grips 4 NBA cities, Boston, Miami, Oklahoma City, and San Antonio. We'll check in. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
From the shores of the Dead Sea comes one of the most significant archaeological finds of the 20th century, the Dead Sea Scrolls, at the Franklin Institute. Featuring more than 600 Holy Land artifacts and a rare glimpse of the authentic Dead Sea Scrolls. Also, a look at millennia-old traditions that continue to impact Western society today. The Dead Sea Scrolls, now open at the Franklin Institute. For tickets, 215-448-1200 or online at fi.edu. The Franklin Institute supports WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. We're in the middle of Philly Beer Work, Philly Beer Week here in the city of Philadelphia. This is a 10-day celebration, and it was begun in 2008. It features festivals and dinners, tours, pub crawls, tastings, meet the brewer nights to all sorts of area bars, restaurants, and other locations throughout Greater Philadelphia. That's reading from a press release. Don Russell with us, Executive Director of Philly Beer Week, also the Philadelphia Daily News' Joe Sixpack, Rich Wagner, beer historian, author of a new book called Philadelphia Beer, and he's a member of the Master Brewers Association of the Americas. And we're taking calls, looks like just one open line, at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get, looks like Janelle from Ambler joining us on Radio Times. And Janelle, go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
This is very interesting. It's one of my favorite pastimes. My question is, historically, what is the difference between beer and ale? And in the 16th and 17th centuries, they drank what they called small ale. Uh-huh. I'm wondering whether that was made in Philadelphia and what it is.
Well, you called the right place because we have a beer historian right here. Go ahead, Rich.
Well, small beer or small ale is basically referring to how much alcohol is in it. So in this Brewer's Day Book from the Perot Brewery, when they would put hot water in the mash tun to extract sugars, the first runnings coming out of the mash tun produce the sweetest liquor or the sweetest liquid that they then boil in the kettle. And what they would do in the 1700s is they would run water through that again, collect more, but they would get less sugar out of it. That would be your middling beer.
Hmm.
And then they did it a third time, and that would be your small beer. So they'd leach out the, whatever remaining sugar they could from your grain and then frequently add molasses to beef it up a little bit because it, by then the grain was pretty much spent.
Huh.
So that was what small beer was, and everybody made it. And in the 1700s, 1600s in the city, that's how they advertised it. A lot of it was bottled. It would be strong, middling, and small. And in answer to your question between beer and ale, today we normally think of ales as being very hoppy, but at a certain point in history, ale was an English beverage made without hops. So to answer your question, it's time. It depends on what time period you're talking about.
And what about session beer?
Session beer is more for Joe to talk about, but
okay.
It's not small beer, but it's not your big beers.
Go ahead.
Right. Well,
go
it's
ahead,
a new term that's out there about basically defining low-alcohol beer that has a full flavor, a beer that you could drink all night for a full session. It's not a term I particularly like too much,
right.
And there's a little bit of been a lot of breweries rather that have been picking up on this and producing newer beers that are of lower alcohol nature.
Very early on, I was out in Yakima. I went to Bert Grant's Brew Pub. He had the first brew pub in America, and he had like a red English style ale that was very, very hoppy, very, very flavorful, but it, I don't even know if it was 3% alcohol. But that was my introduction to the concept that alcohol is just one facet of the whole profile of what's in beer, and you can have really good, flavorful beer without necessarily having a big alcoholic content.
Now, we have two big bottles of beer on the table here. When did the beer can make its appearance?
Well, the beer can was one of the things that revolutionized the industry after Prohibition, and it was introduced in 1935. And by then, some brewers had already gone out of business in the city, but 12 breweries in Philadelphia put beer in cans, and the first one was Esslinger's.
And was it just that cans don't break, or it was easier, the materials were more available, cheaper?
It lightened the load, so you could it cut down on shipping costs. It prevented light from coming in contact with beer, and light is an enemy of beer. They developed a beer can with a cone top that could accept a crown cap so that they could run it in the normal bottling equipment. But that was the main thing. Right. It was lighter weight, no light, and it didn't have to be returned to the brewery. It was one of our early no-deposit, no-returned containers.
Do you care if it's in a beer or can, Don? And then we'll get back to our callers.
Not really. We've seen a resurgence of canned beer these days. They're coming back. It's sort of the can had this image of being, you know, basically a low blue-collar kind of thing to drink beer straight out of the can. But a number of brewers locally, including Sly Fox, have begun canning their beers and proving that a canned beer can be full of flavor. I tend to like to pour the beer out of the cup or out of the can, just to be able to enjoy the aroma a little bit better. But hey, down the beach or the Eagles tailgater, can's fine with me.
Let me get looks like Mike from Claymont to join us on Radio Times. And Mike, go ahead, you're on the air.
Oh, thanks very much for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
My family and friends and neighbors have all been getting into more craft beers. I tend to like really light, smooth beers, and all the craft beers they bring home tend to be kind of hoppy and bitter. I've learned to avoid all the beers that say Hoppinator on them, and I've learned to avoid the IPAs. Is there anything I should look for in terms of descriptions of beer that would be more of a smooth, less hoppy taste to them?
That's a great question. It really is, because a lot of people do think that the craft beers are way too strong or too hoppy. There is so many different flavor profiles of beer these days, so there's a lot more out there. I will tell you that there's a lot of great sweeter beers there, so something that describes itself as maybe a Bock beer would be one to choose.
B-A-C-H?
B-O-C-K.
Oh, B-O-C-K.
It used to just come out in the spring, but you see them more often all year round. And also another style that a lot of people are enjoying that does not have that kind of hoppiness is a Belgian wit beer or white beer, and almost all the breweries around are making something similar to that, or a Saison maybe. Neither of those two styles are particularly hoppy, and they're very smooth and crisp and refreshing.
And here's a basic question for you, Rich. When people say something is a beer is hoppy, what do they mean? Is hoppy?
It's measured in alpha acid. So every hop, when they do it in the lab, it has a rating of how much alpha acid it contains. And that's what you'd call your pure bitterness.
Mm-hmm. And so it's a bitter taste? Is that what it is?
Bitter sensation. Every hop variety has its own unique hop flavor to go along with bitterness. They're two different things. Hoppy beer just means that you're getting more of that hop flavor, and also the bitterness that you feel on your tongue.
Have you had a best beer experience? I mean, one that just one of those memorable, maybe eating, drinking?
I would say it has to be the one that I'm holding right here.
Is that true?
It's Belge that was made and is a collaboration between America and Belgium. The one in my hand is my favorite beer.
I got you.
Okay.
I got you. Does that make
sense? Rich and I are on the same page there. People ask that question all the time, and I always say it's my next beer, and especially if they're buying for me.
Beer in the hand is worth two in the bush.
Okay. Yeah, and you heard that on Radio Times. What was the thinking behind Philly Beer Week? It's now in its fifth year.
It is. I wanted to just correct you one small thing. Oh. You referred to me as the creator, and I got to tell you, there's a lot of people behind Philly Beer Week. I was one of them, but what really happened with what the thinking there is that Philly had or has a really unparalleled beer scene going on right now between its breweries and restaurants and the import scene and the specialty cafes. And it was all those people really that came together and said, we need a way to really push the idea that Philly is a beer destination. And that's what Philly Beer Week is about, is promoting that scene. Not just to out-of-towners. We do get a lot of out-of-towners coming, but I think the one thing that I'm most proud about is how locals have embraced this idea that we have something here that we can really be proud of, something we've got that's better than New York.
I had a guy from...
And we like that.
Yes. I had a guy come from California. He was a rep for one of the big breweries out there, and he said, we just did San Francisco Beer Week last week, and the questions I was getting, it was as if these people knew nothing about beer. And I come to Philadelphia, and the questions I'm getting were so much more sophisticated, and so people are educated about this.
Well, it makes you, people say that about the sports fans in the city as well, is that they know, maybe because they've struggled through so many broken-hearted seasons, but nonetheless, it's an interesting commentary. And to you, Don, I was reading that there are now beer weeks in cities all over the world. Do you think Philadelphia was in part an inspiration?
Oh, it was absolutely the inspiration. We're the first city beer week in the country, and in just 5 years, about 100 of them have cropped up around the world. And most of them give us a nod that it all started here in Philly. But Philly's beer week is at least, you know, 3 to 5 times larger than the next beer week in the country.
Mm. And what's the reputation of Philadelphia beer as you look around the world? I mean, I know you see it as the greatest place for beer in the world, but I'm curious about the city's reputation.
I think it's got a very good reputation. The one thing that in addition, as to Rich mentioned, the beer savvy people here, we also have a reputation for making a lot of different styles of beer. Most areas tend to see one type of beer in the more, you know, one general type of beer. Here the brewers are making everything, especially the lagers, which people have really come to appreciate in this city, which you do not see in the rest of the country, at least not to the broad spectrum that we have here.
Would you agree with that, Rich?
Oh, yeah. We may not have as many breweries as some places, but of course they pick up the slack with beer from other places too.
Yes.
So it's a beer drinking capital.
Right.
It's a beer drinking mecca, not just manufacturing. But we hold our own when it comes to that too.
I'm thinking of your description of a part of Philadelphia, you know, a couple centuries ago, where there were what, 5 or 6 breweries, and I'm assuming it just smelled like beer.
That's what it did. It just go down, stand outside of yards when they're brewing someday. That's what the whole neighborhood smelled like.
Big difference though. They delivered the beer with horses, and we don't have
that.
That's
true.
We don't have that smell anymore.
Right. We have a different smell, but not that particular smell. And there were brew pubs as well?
Yes, they would be called brewery saloons or just taverns.
But the same idea, which is the beer was made there,
yes,
and then you could drink it there as well.
Lots and lots.
Let's see what Bob from Mayfair has to say. And Bob, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning.
There's a great difference in price in a lot of the beers that are for sale.
Yes.
And I'm wondering, does price indicate the difference in the quality of the beer? Like, is there a superior beer and an inferior beer? I'll take my answer off the air.
Sure. Do you get what you pay for, Don?
Generally, I think you do, but I do believe that price is not the best indicator. Price of the quality. Price is more related to two things, I think. One is the alcohol content, which is an indicator of the amount of the ingredients that went into it. And secondly, we're seeing a lot of what I refer to as cult beers, which are not widely distributed. Mm-hmm. And as a result, their prices tend to go up. I mean, if you go on eBay and look for these kinds of beers, you'll see $100, $200 bottles of beer there, which honestly, I think is ridiculous.
Oh, wow. Anything you want to add to that?
No. No, that's good.
Okay, fair enough. Let me get to, looks like Chris from Frankfurt to join our conversation. And Chris, go ahead. You're on the air.
Very quickly, I was just curious, what's the most unusual or unlikely thing that you've ever experienced or seen made into a beer? And also, have any studies been done on the actual healthful benefits of beer? And I'll take my answer.
Yeah, Chris.
Charlie Bamforth just wrote a book exactly on that topic about 2 years ago. So, yes, there's people that are studying this, and there's statistics
about
the health benefits of beer. And Charlie says you drink 2 beers a day, no more, no less, every day. And that's the key to good health. What was the other question?
The other question is the most, I guess, unusual ingredient.
I was doing my colonial brewing demonstration over the weekend, and a home brewer came up to me and said he had tried making a banana and peanut butter beer. That's about the most unusual. And then Prism Brewing in North Wales has a beer with vegan bacon in it.
Right.
So there are two that are pretty unusual.
I don't even know how to think about beer with vegan bacon. What about for you, Dan?
I think pizza beer. I had a beer made with tomatoes and oregano and I think onions.
Oh.
It was actually not as bad as it sounds. It's not distributed locally, but it is bottled out in the Midwest.
Wow. Wow. And are you going to make it through the end of Philly Beer Week, Don Russell?
I am. I will make it there. I'll get to the finish line. It's, Beer Week really, we work on it year-round. It takes a year's worth of planning to get this all to come together. And so for me, it's not nearly as grueling now as it was maybe 2 months ago. Now I get to enjoy all the fruits of that labor.
Well, on that note, thanks for joining us once again to talk about beer, and thank you for bringing some very tasty beer as well. Don Russell, thanks for coming into the studios.
My pleasure.
And he is the executive director of Philly Beer Week, which is underway here in the city of Philadelphia. He's also known as the Philadelphia Daily News' Joe Sixpack. Also with us, Rich Wagner, and thank you, Rich, for joining us as well.
Nice. Thank you.
You're very welcome. And I should say that if you heard that little funny sip earlier in the hour, that was Rich Wagner taking another sip of beer here. And he has written a new book called Philadelphia Beer, A Heady History of Brewing in the Cradle of Liberty. And he is a member of the Master Brewers Association of the Americas. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out much more about this program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Divine, Debbie Builder with Jonathan Best. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us. And we do want to close things out with a tune by Johnny Cash called I Hardly Ever Sing Beer Drinking Songs.
I hardly ever sing beer drinking songs, and when they play them cheating tunes, I never sing along. I never ever sing the blues, I've forgotten born to lose. And I hardly ever sing beer drinking songs. I hardly ever walk the floor and cry, and I don't think I've ever said I feel like I could die. I don't ever lay awake, I never think my heart will break. I hardly ever walk the floor and cry. I hardly ever sing beer drinking songs. I can't put much feeling in saying love has all gone wrong. I don't lose no sleep at night, 'cause things with you are going right. And I hardly ever sing beer drinking songs.